We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What's your name, son?
Danny Bernstein. I'm from Deerfield, Illinois.
Dan Bernstein on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
That's enough. Don't care. Not interested.
Insightful sports talk for your workday from one of Chicago's most respected radio professionals.
Professional what?
Professional penis.
You don't know what the hell you're doing.
Dan Bernstein.
The guy is full of hot air.
In a semi-permanent state of flatulence.
Middays on The Score.
Happy Friday. We're broadcasting live from the Hyundai Store Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. In a few moments, we're going to talk with Patrick Mooney of The Athletic, who's covering the Cubs. Got all sorts of inside information on the Cubs' plans and their current situation, so look forward to getting that. Just posted a story in The Athletic, and he is going to let us know what those plans may be as they try to forge ahead with something to salvage a season. At 9:40, we're going to talk to labor lawyer and negotiating expert Eugene Friedman, who is a consultant with Baseball Prospectus, also works with the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, to let us know about what's real and what's not and what should matter when we start looking at how baseball is discussing what they may be doing. He's a really smart guy and has some terrific information for us. At 10 o'clock, I want to get into these proposed changes in the NFL rules, which I think are pretty cool. And that is one aspect of a pandemic that might actually end up being having a lasting benefit, is that people just seem more open to saying, well, what the hell? We don't know what this is going to look like. As long as we're making sweeping changes to our sports, we might as well incorporate some new ideas that we may not have in the past. And whether or not it accelerates robot umpires and universal DH in MLB, or more sensible understanding of how to litigate some of these arcane NFL stuff, I think it's all good that these possibilities are being considered. Midday Midway at 10:40. And then at 11, we'll do a Friday Fung, because we've got a three-day weekend coming up. I know you might be doing some grilling, and we have Shane Reardon, who happens to be sitting in for Jay Zawoski, so we figured we're going to do SML and call it Shane's Meat Live. And we're going to kind of throw it open for discussions of our grilling and or cooking of various animal proteins throughout this weekend or beyond, with tips, with ideas, with recipes, with thoughts, your questions. If you're a newbie and you have something that's been sitting in your freezer and you've been too intimidated to try to take it on, well, Shane is here for you. And I say that with some degree, certainly, of trepidation. 312-644-6767 is the number at WSCR The Score. You email us at Bernstein@670thescore.com. That's where you listen to us live. We stream at 670thescore.com. Do send a text. When you do, it goes to the text zone. Brought to you by Rosen Hyundai of Algonquin. Save time. Shop online at rosenhyundai.com. When you text 67011, we reply. Message and data rates may apply. Twitter is at Bernstein670. My personal account, if you want to hit me up there, is at Dan_Bernstein. Got to download the radio.com app. You know that. You can stream The Score on your mobile devices, and you can interact with the show and the station on Facebook by liking the 670 The Score page. As mentioned, Shane Reardon is in for Jay Zawoski, who is off today. However, the executioner, Ray Diaz, is the man doing what he does on the board at our Score studios. So I am trying to get my head around what is actually happening with the Cubs here, and trying to be fair and understanding so much
context that is occurring here that makes baseball a bit different. So we find out, David Haw did a lot of this reporting yesterday, and he wrote this up in a piece at 670thescore.com about the Cubs instituting pay cuts. So the pay cuts were imposed Tuesday, ranging from 10% to 35% for their highest paid employees, the latter group including top executives Theo Epstein, Crane Kenny, and David Ross. Team officials determined pay cuts were a better alternative than furloughs for non-paying personnel, so workers could continue to get paid, which is always interesting in how they couch some of this stuff and why. Obviously, teams do this because they want to hang on to more of their money, and there's no money coming in. They can always say, well, we're doing this because of some nebulous idea of the workers. It's because they don't want to lose as much money as they could possibly lose. So according to Patrick Mooney, he says a group of 10 senior Cubs executives, including Theo Epstein, Jed Hoyer, Crane Kenny, began taking pay cuts on May 1st. So there's more in the fine print here. The Cubs notified employees Wednesday that there will be company-wide pay cuts in June, but no furloughs, and this ensures health benefits, but it doesn't necessarily signal the end of the pay cuts. There are no guarantees the Cubs won't impose furloughs later this summer, and this is the number, and if somebody were to ask me how many employees the Cubs had, I probably would have come close to this, but their workforce, and this is obviously I assume full-time workforce, 600 employees. So this is what the size of what they're trying to do here. Now, when I thought about it, when I thought about their number, you know that Tom Ricketts was on a conference call mentioning that 70% of their revenue came from game days. 70% from tickets, concessions, merchandise, and parking. And I thought, when we heard it, we talked about it, and you hear that number, you're like, come on. There is no way that in this day and age, when so much is moving away from that, when so many teams know that in cold April and or the fact that they're bad and people just don't come to games, it's only there's a fraction of the percentage of capacity, that they were moving away from the reliance on game day, that that's much more of like a what used to be looked at as a minor league thing where you better get butts in seats, and saying no, because of baseball advanced media and because of traditional media deals and everything tangential to the team, that most teams weren't as worried about how the product was being consumed. But then you start looking at what's publicly available, and that's what David Haw did. He said information contained in a filing by Liberty Media, the parent company of the Braves, one of the few publicly held sports franchises, gives credence to the Cubs' claim. So he mentions that MLB finances, according to an AP report, peg the league average for percentage of revenue coming in from game day experience at 39%. So the Cubs would be almost double that for what they're claiming. But according to this filing by Liberty Media, they report financials every quarter because they're publicly traded. Liberty finished 2019 with $476 million in total revenue, 63% attributed to game day revenue. That's 63% for the Braves, who ranked 12th in attendance and averaging 32,776 fans. The Cubs were fourth, averaging 38,208 fans. And the Cubs have some of the highest ticket prices anywhere. Plus, they own so many of the businesses around the park. Now, I don't know what's reflected in Cubs revenue as opposed to Ricketts revenue. And there's always a way that you can play that shell game and move some of the numbers around. But I was intrigued to learn how plausible some of this stuff is. And that's why the Cubs are in a uniquely dangerous position vis-a-vis sports and crowds and entertainment, because they doubled down on the event aspect of Cubs baseball. They became more vulnerable to a pandemic of a novel virus, more vulnerable to massive changes in what we understand the idea of gatherings to be. And I, when you maybe Boston would be another example of a team that is that vulnerable, but it's easy to say that, to paint the Cubs as somehow villainous in here, and to say, oh, here's the big bad Ricketts family, and they're imposing these pay cuts, and there's going to be furloughs, and they're taking money out of everybody's pocket, when you compare them perhaps to what other teams are doing, and other teams keeping people paid in full for longer. Obviously, if there's no money coming through, sure, they're worth whatever it is, $3 billion. But being worth that doesn't matter unless you're borrowing against that to help pay people. That's like equity in your house, that unless you're actually trying to make it liquidity, it doesn't mean anything. You can say, yeah, these billionaires are this team is worth this. Yes, the franchise is worth this. But until you sell it, that's sort of an abstract concept of the idea of worth. That's not the same as revenue. It's not the same as cash coming through. The Cubs business model does make them apparently uniquely vulnerable, not just now, but going forward, for what they are going to be, how they are going to imagine this. Look in what they've invested. The density of population, the density, they essentially, the Cubs doubled down. The Cubs really made their bet on mass gatherings, the rooftops, all the clubs and all the restaurants and the Gallagher Way and everything around the park is based on the bet on the communal experience. So I wonder about this, about how, in what kind of danger this business model is. Now, you can say, sure, lose a little bit of money and take care of everybody. I don't know the truth. I don't know exactly what they could do, because when ownership says we have to, it usually means they want to or don't want to. When they cry poor and pay the players, we can't. Of course you can pay the players. Ahead of this, before they shut everything down, any team that says they couldn't pay free agents is lying. And any team can sign any free agent, and that all changed now with these differing bottom lines respective to what's happening with no games. But there's also the context of the looming labor squabble. And I wonder when teams, and especially a team as prominent as the Cubs, a leader among teams brand-wise, if it's important going into a labor negotiation that they put it out there, that they try to get some of this in the bloodstream and try to say, well, look where we are, look at our given situation, look at our unique vulnerabilities. So to think that we're some massive behemoth that's able to withstand all that, not necessarily the case, that I can't get out of my head that a lot of the way the teams are positioning themselves publicly has to do with anticipating a labor negotiation, which they decided to make more public. As we talked to Ian Happ about it yesterday. The owners, knowing that no matter what the players say, and it's not just unfortunate stuff like the way Blake Snell says it, even if players are saying, well, we're concerned about health, people will generally assume that it's the greedy players that are making this all happen. The fact is that we don't know. The Cubs are a private business, and we don't know what they could do, what they don't want to do, and what they feel they have to do when it comes to some of these pay cuts. I don't know the answer to that. 312-644-6767. And I'm not sure if you as a Cub fan, if it's going to really affect you at all, affect the way you feel about your team. Because the Cubs have acted essentially bulletproof when it comes to their fan base. We know this from the Joe Ricketts emails. A poll?
Yeah, you said? Put a poll up on the Bernstein 670 Twitter account. You think that the fans aren't affected by it. 72.8% so far say figure it out and pay your staff. 27.2% say it doesn't change my opinion of your organization. It's a pandemic.
Well, I would like to know. I think it's important to know how they are similar or different to all the other teams, especially the major market teams. I would like to know what if what they're doing is drastically different, because it's so easy to say, well, the miserly Cubs just want to hang on to their money and not pay their people. Or, then we've got to find out if they did pay everybody, you know, at some point, someone's going to suffer, right? At some point, either they're going to say, well, these non-essential people or game day people aren't going to be taken care of, that the lower level people would lose health care while, you know, Theo Epstein is down, you know, is down 35%. Nobody's coming and kicking him out of his house or taking away his health care. So I wonder, and there's also, you know, a good question here where Coach Tom says, what about the 9% amusement tax? That how is that affected? And I don't know the answer to that. So do the Cubs pay a 9% amusement tax? So that's a huge nut to pull from the face value of your tickets.
I'm looking right now.
Yeah, the all good questions. Patrick Mooney of The Athletic, 12% amusement tax?
As you may know, the current amusement tax on tickets to sporting events in Chicago like Cubs games is at 12%. Wait, that might be the consumer. That might be the consumer.
Okay.
I'm going to find it for you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
that's Patrick Mooney wrote this up too, and he's got information on what the Cubs' plans are. He's got team sources telling him what they are expecting, what they're not expecting, and for what they are planning. He is going to join us next. I'm Dan Bernstein. You got Sports Radio 670, The Score.
Hey, Scoreheads, big news. Interacting with your favorite Score shows is now easier than ever. Check this out. You can call and text the Score guys at one number. 312-644-6767. Yep, it's the same number you've called for years. But now you can call and text at the same number. How easy is that? Again, from now on, text and call your favorite Score shows at one number. 312-644-6767. Remember, 67011 will no longer be active for text. Just one number to talk and text the Score. 312-644-6767. Message and data rates may apply. Don't text and drive.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
Just because you spend a lot of money doesn't mean you're going to win. We've seen that in our own organization the last couple years. We saw that our first year where we had the third highest payroll and maybe the 22nd best record. I mean, the fact is that it's not really about how much you spend. It's about where you spend it and getting the right guys on board.
This segment is brought to you by DuckDuckGo Privacy. Tired of being tracked online? DuckDuckGo can help. They help millions of people like you take control of their personal information online. With one download, you can search and browse privately, avoiding trackers, all for free. DuckDuckGo Privacy Simplified. The voice of Tom Ricketts. Before, well, everything changed. And now they are dealing with some unique problems because of how they have built their business. Patrick Mooney of The Athletic wrote Cubs Business today, and he's with us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. You can follow him on Twitter at PJ_Mooney. Patrick, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks, Dan. How are you?
I'm okay. Good enough. I read with interest some of what you're writing about how the Cubs are, I guess the term that I used was uniquely vulnerable to some of this upheaval right now, because where other teams in baseball had been going in the opposite direction of being less reliant on actual traffic and butts in seats, where the Cubs went the other way, that they put their bet on masses of people being in and around the ballpark. Is that fair enough, or is that an oversimplification to say almost as an event business, the Cubs created some vulnerability to pandemic that maybe other teams don't have?
Well, I think pretty much across the board, the big market teams are saying that they're going to be taking, you know, huge losses, and all these numbers are kind of taken with a grain of salt. We saw the presentation to the union that the Associated Press obtained. And, yeah, I mean, I think this year you can kind of, you know, cover those losses, whatever they may be. I think it's not just about 2020, though. I think it kind of gets to what you're saying at this kind of existential threat to what the Cubs are, what the Red Sox are, what the Dodgers are. And that's, you know, bringing in 3 million fans a year. Wrigley Field is, by one metric, the most expensive family experience in baseball, according to the team marketing report. And obviously the Cubs, you know, renovated Wrigley Field and built it out, you know, a project that has gotten a lot of very good reviews over the years. But you can't become a year-round destination when everyone is forced to stay at home. And, you know, the Cubs or any of these other big market teams don't know when the fans can come back, you know, if they'll come back, the scale of these events and the shape, the state of their corporate partners, and you know, just how much disposable income you know, fans will have when I think it was almost 39 million Americans have filed for unemployment at this point.
How do the Cubs' plans for these pay cuts and or potential furloughs, how do these square with what other major market teams are doing for their workforces? And you say that there's 600 employees. I assume this is one of the larger businesses, individual businesses in MLB. And I'm trying to be fair because it's always very easy to talk about a big evil ownership that just is trying to scrimp on every penny they can. But are the Cubs, is this standard MLB practice what they're doing at the moment?
That's a good question. I think you've seen the White Sox, who have a smaller organization, I would say, you know, kind of give assurances to their employees. The Cardinals did as well. Other teams took more, you know, extreme measures or started this process before the Cubs did. I think a lot of teams are taking this month by month, you know, kind of crossing their fingers and hoping that somehow baseball can start up in July. There's, you know, a June draft that, you know, teams, even a shortened one, that teams are preparing for remotely, which I think gives some, you know, cover on the baseball operations side. But yeah, no doubt. I mean, the Ricketts family has really invested in the team. I think in general, employees think it's a good place to work. The overall kind of compensation and benefits packages are favorable to what it was under the Tribune years. But no doubt, when you don't, you know, when revenues just kind of, you know, vanish in the middle of spring training, they're obviously going to be taking some measures. And I think that however the Cubs handle this and however they emerge from this will definitely be, you know, part of the Ricketts family's legacy.
I know this would be looked at as sort of rank opportunism, but I can't help but think that if I were in charge of the Comcast marquee negotiation with the Cubs, that the bargaining position for Comcast is now at a point where it's been laid bare that they need TV revenue. The Cubs do more than ever. That if, in fact, if you just envision a long time before there's 40,000 fans there, there may be games, there may eventually be some fans, but unless there is not just a vaccine within the next 12 to 18 months, but one with unquestioned efficacy that may not even have to be some sort of seasonalized vaccine, once we start looking at the science, that Comcast can drive a much harder bargain because of what it's going to mean for as a revenue stream for the Cubs.
Well, I think one thing that hasn't changed you know, since this outbreak is that companies make a lot of money off the Cubs, and I think that there will be financial incentives for both sides. I think each side knows each other really well, since the Cubs obviously had a long-time partnership in Comcast Sportsnet. Obviously, March 26th was the day that was circled on the calendar. These negotiations usually need a pressure point, and opening day was it. I think you would hope, and maybe this is hopelessly naive, that kind of like the owners and the players union, that both sides could see the bigger picture and kind of deliver for their customers. But I'd imagine that if the Cubs can, you know, start preseason camp at some point in June and we get kind of an 82-game schedule written in pencil, that maybe that will really force both sides to hunker down and hammer out a deal.
You did paint a relatively optimistic picture, as you said, according to sources with knowledge of the team's thinking. It does sound like that they're preparing for something to happen here. Like whoever you're talking to gave you some pretty specific information about there being baseball this year.
Well, I think it's not just the Cubs. I mean, the Cubs have really taken their direction from Major League Baseball. And, you know, my colleagues at The Athletic, who essentially cover every team in baseball, covered at a national level. I mean, I think no one knows this is actually going to work, but everyone knows that there are enormous financial incentives and that even if there are these just kind of unfathomable challenges to stage in the 82-game season, you know, both sides are going to try. And unfortunately, they can't just isolate or focus on one issue. Obviously, Ian Happ was on your show yesterday, you know, talking about this, of hopes for a, you know, fair and equitable deal on the economics. You know, I think when this possibility looked a lot darker, you know, Anthony Fauci, you know, someone who obviously has, you know, a ton of credibility, was kind of open to various plans. And, you know, now you can see things, you know, starting to reopen up. But, you know, on the other hand, there is not a uniform strategy to opening up. So there are going to be some obstacles for team to team or city to city. But there's no doubt that they're going to try. And I think it's not, you know, just Major League Baseball. You can see the NBA, which has the benefit of a commissioner and kind of a league office that has, you know, the trust and cooperation of the NBA Players Union, which is, you know, certainly not the case in Major League Baseball.
You mentioned some of these specific plans about the Cubs expanding their footprint at Wrigley Field, using both clubhouses, using the concourses, using the office building and or facilities at local colleges for staggered schedules. So there, some have floated the idea of Arizona and or Florida spring trainings. You think that if they, from jump, when it's time to, when they put a date on this thing, and if in fact that there's agreement, that this would all be happening here?
That is the preference. That doesn't mean it will happen. And obviously, you've been to their facility in Mesa. There's a lot more room there. It's easier to socially distance. There's, you know, multiple fields and enormous weight room. But, you know, being in the desert in the middle of June is certainly not ideal. And since this schedule will be regionalized, I think it, you know, could make sense to try to set up base in Chicago and also give players and their families a little, you know, sense of normal in a way that, you know, Arizona wouldn't. That is obviously subject to approval from local authorities, as well as, you know, what we're talking about here, this larger economic picture that hasn't been resolved yet.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, too, because so many of the deals that they do and so much of their business, you know, we're still so laser-focused on this season, about how some of the sponsorship arrangements that have provisions going multiple seasons here, like how much business can actually get done, even if they're trying to make, quote-unquote, post-pandemic plans. Aren't they almost completely paralyzed by, you know, just lack of information right now? I mean, what do you tell potential sponsors? What do you tell people who would be, who have no idea how to value signage, depending on the number of eyes that are on it? Or you know, what does a PA announcement mean if there aren't people there to hear it? How do they know how much anything is worth right now?
Exactly. And how do you project what the free agent market is going to look like next winter, the year after that? Can players anticipate those types of long-term commitments? I think even without a pandemic, you were looking at a waiver deal that was set to expire after the 2021 season. And really this kind of hardened positions within the players union that, a generation of players that had grown up in kind of, you know, relative labor peace, all of a sudden saw, you know, players like Bryce Harper and Manny Machado being unsigned, you know, into spring training and, you know, teams kind of writing off big league seasons for draft picks and, you know, kind of keeping their powder dry or preserving financial flexibility, you know, whatever, however they termed it, you know, that was kind of the reality already. And now you have a, you know, pandemic and a global recession kind of thrown on top of that. And it's really impossible to say, you know, where teams will be a week from now, much less, you know, 2025.
Patrick, really good stuff. Appreciate it. And have a terrific long weekend and continued good health.
Thanks, Dan. You too.
That is Patrick Mooney of The Athletic with some with a sprawling piece up here with a lot of Cubs at business stuff. We talked to Ian Happ yesterday, and he said some diplomatic things about how the players and how the owners can sit down and try to figure out how to get back on the field safely and fairly. And I was also following on Twitter a lawyer named Eugene Friedman, who put a fascinating thread together about just how facile some of the coverage has been and the writing has been. Hey, why can't you two just sit down and work this out? Make something happen. You guys all just do this. And what it means when we say some of these things. He is an experienced labor negotiator, knows a lot about what is upcoming and how this is all going to happen. And he can let us know what's real when we start talking about this desire to see baseball again. And we'll figure out what's probable and what's possible with Eugene Friedman. He's going to join us next. I'm Dan Bernstein, 9 to noon, Monday through Friday, live and local on The Score.
670 The Score celebrates 25 years of Dan Bernstein.
Well, if today's show and the amount of fun that I had doing it is any indication of the kind of fun we're going to have, I'm very excited.
You're crushing my male unit.
Hashim the beat. He comes to me in my bed.
Fantastic. Take that, Bernstein.
Dan Bernstein and Terry Bohr is with you until noon on The Score, Sports Radio 1160.
I'll never call again.
Well, and thank you.
I'm a listener. Look, this is the God's honest truth. I am a sports radio listener, and I react the same way to things.
A big thanks to Dan Bernstein for 25 great years on 670 The Score. Here's to another 25.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
This segment is brought to you by North Shore University Health Systems. Dan Bernstein with you on Sports Radio 670 The Score. And we had been looking forward to a conversation with Eugene Friedman that we may have to reschedule for a bit later on. Getting a little bit of NBA news here. Just got word that Jerry Sloan, the former Chicago Bulls great and Utah Jazz coach, has passed away due to complications from Parkinson's disease and Lewy body dementia at the age of 78. And that's sad because Jerry Sloan, from my time covering him as a coach, he was always as straight a shooter as I've ever been around, figuratively, that he was always available, always unpretentious, on the list of somebody who was just a real dude. And from all the time that I spent around Norm Van Leer as a coworker, when Norm would talk about Jerry Sloan, they were sort of an unlikely backcourt odd couple with some very, very different personalities, but a genuine tough guy And his when he would wear that John Deere hat, it wasn't some sort of populist pretense. It's because that would be a guy who would be in the back 40 on a tractor in a happy place there. He was a tremendous basketball player. And I can also say that I was, as a fan, I was 9 years old, I believe, when I got to be at Chicago Stadium on the night he was honored, Jerry Sloan night, when they retired his number and brought it up to the rafters, or as Danny Parkins would say, the raptors. Jerry Sloan was as tough a basketball player, at least when Norm Van Leer describes your toughness, when Norm Van Leer describes you as a teammate, the way he talked about Jerry Sloan, that was a pretty special player and somebody who's remembered from what was some very fun times of Bulls basketball that got short shrift, by the way, from Jason Hayer in The Last Dance, when they used Tom Boerwinkle as an example of like the lean times or what the bad times for the Bulls brand. Tom Boerwinkle was a hell of a basketball player too, and didn't deserve to be treated in that regard. For those of us who remember how I think a guy had 37 rebounds in a game at one point. And you got to see a little of Jerry Sloan in The Last Dance, but it's too bad. A really good guy, a really tough guy, a terrific basketball player, and a terrific coach who brought in, and actually Jerry Sloan should be remembered by Bulls fans as the guy who used principles from Dick Motta and from those great Bulls teams during the 70s and applied them to John Stockton and Karl Malone and a lot of the sets that they ran and got them to much higher heights. We get a chance now to talk to an experienced labor lawyer and find out exactly why some of the reporting about baseball right now is missing the mark. Eugene Friedman joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Hello, Eugene. How are you?
Good. Good morning.
Good morning. I was very intrigued by a Twitter thread that I saw Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. He retweeted it. I saw it, and I went back and did sort of a deep dive on some of what you were writing. I guess I didn't really think about it until you put it this way. For when guys like Bob Nightingale, Joel Sherman, if we're naming names, national baseball writers say, hey, players, owners, just get this done. Why is that more loaded of a sentiment than it seems?
Well, the hardest part about collective bargaining, about negotiating a term agreement, and a lot of these national writers are now saying, oh, don't just get a deal, you know, in the next couple weeks on health and safety, but get a deal on finances, revamping the entire pay structure of Major League Baseball, because, you know, it's for the good of the game. That's really the message that they're putting out. And, you know, I've viewed it as they're putting out a message on behalf of the owners. And the reason for that that's impossible to get a deal over the entirety of a pay system is that that's something that takes a lot of work, a lot of internal difficult discussions within each team. And by team, in this case, I mean contract team. So the players will have a team that goes to the table for them, and management will have a team that goes to the table for them. You can't revamp an entire pay structure that's been in place for decades in the course of 2 or 3 weeks. It would take probably 2 or 3 months just for the players and their team to have an understanding of what management wants to do in this circumstance. And then it'll take them some time to come up with counter proposals. And just historically, this idea of a 50-50 revenue sharing system, similar to what's in the collective bargaining agreements in the NBA and NFL, are things that Major League Baseball management has proposed to the players for decades and have been rejected. So they're really using this crisis to try to push a long-term agenda that they have been unsuccessful achieving in good times, and they're trying to use basically what's considered shock doctrine to force an issue during a crisis and achieve a goal that is otherwise unachievable.
It sounds to me then like the only way that we're going to get whatever they envision a salvaged 2020 season to look like, if this is going to happen and the optimism is going to be merited, is if the players tell the owners straight up before they even sit down at the table that we are only talking about a temporary agreement to return. Table everything regarding any larger idea of trying to cement in a different business model. Is that the message that you would be sending right now if you were representing the players, this idea of whatever grand ideas you might have to try to take advantage of us not happening? If you want baseball back now, this is purely a temporary negotiation for what we are doing right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Tony Clark has, to the limited degree that he has made public statements, has made that message pretty clear that they did agree to something back in late March. And that was a prorated salary payment for however many games are played. Now, I know that there's a disagreement as to what the agreement actually meant. Or maybe it's a false disagreement. The players believe that they've already agreed what salaries will look like for this short season, partial season, whatever you want to call it. And I think they have a good argument that it is agreed to. Now, they may have granted the owners, or management in this case, the opportunity to not play a season at all if it's not financially feasible. That's different than saying, well, if the owners decide that they don't like the agreement because they don't like the financial terms of what they've already agreed to, that they can reopen it. It's a under labor law, it's considered a wages or pay, in this case, is a mandatory subject of bargaining. And once the parties have agreed on a mandatory subject to bargaining, it takes mutual consent to reopen that. And the players are basically saying, we've agreed to this. We're not going to reopen it. We will discuss health and welfare. We'll discuss scheduling. We'll discuss all of these other terms and conditions of employment. But we're not going to discuss pay because we've already agreed on it. And it's kind of interesting that lawyers who have an attorney-client privilege and attorney-client confidentiality somehow leaked an internal document to Joel Sherman that was supposedly a smoking gun, saying, when we talked to the players' representatives, we agreed that we would revisit this issue. That just really screams of two things. One is that Joel Sherman is just a leak machine from Major League Baseball's offices. They just give him talking points and he puts them out there. And two, that the management side is operating in bad faith. Why would they put this out if not to try to undermine the relationship with the players themselves? They have to reach an agreement with the players. They have to work with them. They're employees of these organizations. It's a multi-employer arrangement, basically, because each club has its own employees. But, you know, they have to work together, and they're basically saying, we want a fight. And that's not a way to get an agreement.
Lastly, and we've got about a minute here, as we're talking with Eugene Friedman, experienced labor lawyer who works as a consultant with Baseball Prospectus on some of this stuff as well. Deals are done at deadlines. When would we need something concrete to understand when an actual 11th hour would be? Like, as you see this timetable shaping up and we start looking at a calendar, and the days tick by, we should know at some point relatively soon what their deadline is, no?
Well, I think that that's a little bit proprietary to Major League Baseball. I mean, they probably know what their drop-dead timeline is for salvaging a reasonable season, whatever that may look like. And, you know, I think the players have an idea themselves, but the players are taking the position right now, and I think rightfully so, that they're not really looking at a timeline until they can be assured that their members' health and safety is protected. And I think that that's the right position to take because, you know, they're not essential workers. They're not people who are protecting the public interest. You know, they're not firefighters, EMTs, air traffic controllers, other people who have to go to work in these circumstances in order for the country to run and in order to protect safety and health of the public. They are, in this case, entertainers. It's probably the least essential business. And so they're saying, until you can make it clear to our satisfaction that our members are protected, we may not want to come back to work. So I don't think they have the same deadline, and that may be an issue to this where the parties don't have an agreed set of principles or interests in this negotiation.
Eugene, appreciate it very much. It's all very solid information. It's complicated stuff that I know fans are just, they want their baseball back, but these are certainly unique circumstances we've never seen before. So thanks for helping us sort it all out.
Thank you. And, you know, I want baseball back too. I'm a huge fan.
Eugene Friedman, our guest on Sports Radio 670 WSCR, The Score. We've got potential new NFL rules coming. There are proposals out there that are being voted on that are kind of cool. So Eric Edholm, NFL draft columnist for Yahoo and NFL writer for Yahoo, is going to join us next to go over some of these things. And we'll look for unintended consequences, intended consequences, and see how football can change when it comes back. He joins us next on Sports Radio 670, The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.